It would grow old if I said it every single Sunday, but I want to say it this Sunday. Choir, the contribution you make to this service is incalculable. I'm surprised sometimes by what provokes a sermon. I was leafing through a religious journal last week and came across this strange title for a sermon: The Fleas of Faith. That's fleas as in little jumping insects. The Fleas of Faith. I tried to imagine what fleas might have to do with faith, but I didn't get it until I read a few paragraphs. The argument was that the doubts which trouble our minds from time to time are like the fleas on a dog, a kind of stimulus to keep us from being too comfortable. In fact, the sermon quoted an English aristocrat who said that well-washed and well-combed domestic dogs grow dull. They miss the stimulus of fleas. Well, I feel considerable sympathy for people who create sermons, but I have a problem with comparing religious doubt to fleas on a dog. Maybe that's all doubt is to some people, just an occasional minor nip to wake them up for an instant. But the analogy is not strong enough to fit my case. My doubts have been more like persistent packs of wild dogs coming back again and again to see if they can drag me down. Much more worrisome than fleas, but also a kind of paradoxical blessing when they force me to examine what I believe and why I believe it. I've seen dogs idly scratch fleas even in their sleep. I think our religious doubts are much more vicious than that sometimes. They wake us up and won't let us go back to sleep. When I think of doubt, I think of Christ calling out from the cross to a God who has vanished. Why have you forsaken me? Or maybe, why have you, of all people, forsaken me? Bible scholars, as I know many of you are aware, argue about what things Jesus actually said and what things were put into his mouth later on by the church. But it's hard not to believe that cry was really a part of his last few minutes. The Lord of the church calling out the ultimate despair, why have you forsaken me? Who would have wanted to make that up when it makes Jesus so human, so much like us in the loneliest moments of our lives? The doubt that plagued Jesus in that moment on the cross was not some little flea nipping at his ankles. It was a mountain falling smack dab on top of the faith that had kept him going. One moment, Father, into your hands I surrender my spirit, and in the next, where are you? But that wild mood swing shouldn't surprise us, because great faith and great doubt are the twin sisters of any passionate and deeply curious life. We think of Martin Luther as one of the greatest defenders of true faith that ever lived. But he understood perfectly the power of faith's sister, doubt. Listen carefully to this amazing statement. Nobody in this life, Luther said, is nearer to God than those who hate and deny him. And he has no more pleasing, no more dear children than these. Now that's such an extraordinary judgment that we need to be sure we heard it right. So I want you to listen one more time. Nobody in this life is nearer to God than those who hate and deny him, and he has no more pleasing, no more dear children than these. And then we need to be sure we understand it. So let me quote someone I think did understand Luther's remarkable insight, a religious historian by the name of Will Herberg. These are his words. Luther's statement, however shocking and extreme, points to a profound truth. Unless God matters infinitely, he does not matter at all. There is something absolute about faith which demands everything or nothing. Faith is not just one more interest or attachment in life, side by side with other interests or attachments. This is what Luther was saying. Now really listen. The passionate unbeliever who hates and denies God may be all wrong in his ideas, but at least he takes God seriously. This kind of believer is no mere unbeliever. He is rather an anti-believer whose life is a wrestling with God. He does not take God for granted. For that reason, Luther insists, he is near to God and dear to him. Now Luther, I'm sure, was remembering Jacob in that strange story that says he wrestled with God all night, fought with him beside the dark waters of a dangerous river, cried out, "I won't turn loose until you bless me." And finally got the blessing. It's one of the oddest tales in the Bible. I think it's trying to say through its bizarre symbolism that God is not easy. And Luther must also have been remembering Job, that wildly grieving man who in his hour of terrible tragedy hated and denied God, called God names, screamed out his broken-hearted despair and doubt with such blazing honesty that he won God's respect. Why does the Bible have such stories except to tell us that for some, faith will not be easy? There is, of course, a simple sort of faith that never asks a question or dares to face the answer. But great faith, deep and powerful faith, has always walked hand in hand with doubt. The great Russian Christian Dostoevsky suspected privately that doubt was an angel, not a devil. And so he wrote, "My hosannas have been forged in the crucible of doubt. My songs of praise, in other words, have flowered from my most despairing moments." I like the analogy. One almost melts a sword in the fire before it can be fashioned into a weapon. After all, even on the ultimate topic of whether or not God Himself exists, thoughtful people and honest people find themselves vacillating between faith and skepticism. Belief, after all, is not knowledge. And until knowledge comes, doubt never stops plaguing us. It's only when we know something that we're no longer vulnerable to doubt. I know, for example, that a flame will burn my hand. I would not say to a child about to stick his hand in the fire, "Pardon me, but I believe that might burn you." I know it. But I haven't always known it. At some point after my mother first told me, I tested the proposition. And I've never doubted since. But you see, not all the things we're told can be proved that way. The existence of God, for example. We can't set up a demonstration like holding our fingers in a flame. All we can do is listen, read, interpret the evidence, and the evidences can be as persuasive on one side of that question as they are on the other. I know exactly what I have just said. I'll never forget the exceptionally bright student I had once who said she wanted to write a term paper that would prove the existence of God. I tried to discourage her for several reasons, although the only one I used was that the subject was simply too big to handle in a term paper. But she insisted. And she came back at last with the conclusion I had expected, that the existence of God can neither be proved nor disproved. It is a matter of faith, and the wild dogs of doubt are always lurking just beyond the edge of the campfire. Listen to a biblical character in his moment of doubt. And see if you have not felt this way some night, terrified by what the doctor said, worried sick about a child, wrung out by the failure of a marriage. "I cry aloud to God," this man says, "and in the night I lift my outspread hands in prayer, but I find no comfort. When I call God to mind, darkness comes over my spirit. I think of days gone by and remember years of long ago. I ask myself, has He stopped loving us? Has God forgotten how to be merciful? And what hurts most is that God no longer seems," he says, "to be in charge." Now, somebody we know felt like that only last night. And yet those words were written nearly 3,000 years ago. Technology changes, but the eternal cries of the heart sound the same. Oh, I know that some people claim never to have doubted, but if it's true, they are a different order of humanity from people we read about in the Bible, and most of us are incapable of understanding that. How could anyone who had ever thought seriously for a moment not wonder at times whether the world has any sense or meaning? How whoever it is that believers call God could have made a world with so much innocent suffering? I suppose it's possible to avoid some doubt and questioning if we can manage to surrender our minds completely to some institution. Ignatius Loyola, after whom schools are named, in his 13th rule for the spiritual life, said, "We ought always to be ready to believe that what we see as white is black if the church so defines it." But instead of admiring that, I think it's the most dangerous thing in the world. Blind faith has never struck me as a virtue. We do not encourage it in this congregational church. I've never read a more eloquent statement of how we feel than this one from a rather surprising source, Oscar Hammerstein II. Try to register every wise word of it. Too many people become certain about too many things too early in their lives. Overeager to have everything settled, they lack both the wisdom and the courage to expose their hastily adopted ideas to healthy doubt. They cling with blind passion to their false certainties, and too often are ready to kill or be killed for them. In these immature absolutists lie the seeds of tragedy. The earth is sick with them. The certainties of strong men and women are built on a structure of resolved doubt. By the time they reach a conclusion, they have traveled the hard road of reason. Even then, they will be tolerant of another's beliefs and willing always to compare them fairly with their own. The person with a civilized mind is neither afraid nor ashamed to change it. Your uncritical loyalty to weak ideas cannot make them strong. Let them survive or die according to their merit. It is only in ideas honestly and bravely tested that you will find security. I'll give you a copy to hang on the refrigerator door. We have to remember that doubt is not the same as cynicism. Doubt is an active thing, born in a question, a passionate, sincere question. It cares. It wants to know. It can lead us somewhere. Cynicism is something else. Cynicism is a closed shop. It isn't interested in struggling with questions. It has settled for easy answers. I have great respect for doubt. I have only contempt for cynicism. I like people. You may decide I've known the wrong ones, but I like people who admit to having gone through life with their hands outstretched, feeling their way precariously through the darkness, unable to buy everything the believer says, unwilling to buy everything the doubter says. People who say over and over again what that nameless man said to Christ one day, "Sir, I believe. Please help my unbelief." What a great and honest moment that is. "I believe," he says, "but sometimes I don't. I have faith at times, sir, but I have my doubts too." If you can't relate to that man, then it seems to me you have never wrestled with doubt or seen it minister finally to a wiser faith, and I have failed this morning to be of any help to you. But if you do relate, I would invite you to feel a little more compassion for that disciple named Thomas, who very sensibly wanted whatever proof was possible for his faith, and has the misfortune now of having his name linked with the put down we intend when we call someone a doubting Thomas. I think I might have liked Thomas, who probably deserves a much better press than he has had. We can't resolve all our doubts in the way he handled one of his. But let me tell you about a Christian gentleman, F.W. Robertson, who was assailed by doubt, as all great believers are, but had a way of handling it you might find useful. He would rehearse in his mind the things he felt sure about. Now I begin to quote him. "In that fearful loneliness of spirit," he says of doubt, "I know but one way in which a person may come forth from agony without harm. It is by holding fast to those things which are certain still, grand, simple landmarks. In the darkest hour through which a human soul can pass, whatever else is doubtful, this at least is certain. If there be no God and no future state, yet even then my faith is that it is better to be generous than selfish, better to be chaste than licentious, better to be true than false, better to be brave than a coward." Well, that surely sustains some of us while we wait for greater confidence to come. We can take comfort from one who walked and talked over and over with Christ and still wasn't always sure. Our brother doubted. doubting Thomas.